Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview with actor Anne Gundersheimer, who is one of the two characters in the two-character play The Guys, which will be showing on September 11th at The Players. The Guys is a play about some of the fallout from 9/11. It sounds fascinating, as does Anne's story. So hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Hello, and welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about self-discovery. In a way, it's about courage. The courage to ask yourself the question, am I all of who I really am? Am I living the life that my innate nature, my innate talent, my given essence would have made possible? Or was there a lesson that I learned from my family of origin, from a teacher in school, from the culture I was raised in, from my siblings or my peers, from my religion, from something I read or heard, from some traumatic event that occurred in my life that told me not to be who I really am? Was there something that happened to me early on in my life that discouraged me from pursuing the things that turned me on? Maybe even something I knew that turned me on at the very beginning of my life. If you've been listening to my interviews, then you know that so many of the people that I interview, people who make their living or their life with an art, knew at two what they were meant to do, what they were drawn to, what they had passion for, what they yearned to be part of. I think it was last week, I played the interview with Joyce Valentine, who sat down and played at two what her mother had been teaching a seven-year-old student. This was not negotiable. Joyce knew that the piano was the place for her, virtually from the time she could stand, apparently. And this is not that uncommon. I hear this story a lot from musicians, ironically. People who started playing at two or three or four. But I also hear this from fine artists, people who picked up a pencil or a crayon or something and were doing amazing things with it and could not actually be parted from it. I think it was Gail Fulton Ross who tells the story of how her mother had to put her crayons and drawing stuff outside, otherwise she couldn't get Gail to go out. And so it's just not uncommon for people to discover so young, so early in life, what they are drawn to, what they have a passion for, what speaks to them. I think it was Kate Alexander, a brilliant actor, who told me that she remembers sitting on a stage. She had gone to see a performance, and she was on the stage with her feet hanging over the stage, thinking, this is where I want to be. I think she was seven. She didn't really know what acting was, but she knew that she wanted to be there. So, this is not uncommon, and yet, unfortunately, few of us are given the encouragement to follow our natural inclinations. And this doesn't just apply to talents, abilities, skills that we might have been drawn to or attracted to or that spoke to us. This is also true, perhaps even more true, to ways of being. Did you laugh out loud at the kitchen table? Did you laugh so hard at the kitchen table that food spilled out of your mouth or your nose or something? And then were you told in no uncertain terms that that kind of laughing is a bad, bad thing? Leave the table or just don't do it or something? And so did you decide that a certain kind of explosive joy was not for you? That you were not to feel that, express that? Did you get angry or hurt or cry or frightened? And did you hear from a religious person or a teacher that that was not good behavior? You were not to get angry. Anger was the devil's something, or was unattractive, or didn't get you anywhere, or maybe you were even punished for it. Go to your room. Who do you think you are? Don't do that. And of course, this, you know, applies across the board to every kind of behavior, every kind of impulse. Did you want to read all the time? And did someone tell you that that was not okay? I interviewed a writer once who told me that he would write these little stories when he was quite young, 6, 7, 8, and hide them around the house. And that his mother found one of them, and in it he had said some things about a neighbor that weren't true, it was fiction, but they weren't very nice. And his mother was horrified and forbid him to write again. In this particular case, it didn't do any good. This was Stuart Kaminsky, who prolific doesn't begin to describe Stuart's output. And unfortunately, we could have had so much, much, much more from Stuart, but he died much too young. But he did leave us a huge, huge legacy. And if you're not familiar with Stuart Kaminsky's work, especially if you like mystery fiction, run right out to your local library and read Stuart Kaminsky. We hear these things, we get these experiences, things happen to us in our childhood which discourage us from sometimes just from completely expressing, exploring our passion. And that is, to some extent, the story of Anne Gundersheimer, whose interview you will hear in a while. But for many, it's not just an interruption. It's a flat-out denial. You will not be like that. You will not do that. That is not okay. I won't love that. So I won't love you if you are like that. And that's, of course, how we interpret it. Or that's dangerous, or it's ugly, or it's evil. And so too many of us are forced, in order to survive our childhoods, in order to be okay in our childhoods, to hide, pretend, deny aspects of ourselves. I'm a psychotherapist, in case you couldn't tell and didn't know because you're listening for the first time. So I am a psychotherapist, and of course this is my bias. My bias is that we have the right to be what we would have been if we had not been discouraged, and that it is never too late to ask the question, was there something I could have been, might have been, should have been? And what was it, and how did I lose it? And it is my belief that we never lose it, that all those things that we are go underground. I call it undercover. We bury them deep inside ourselves, but we don't lose them. We can't amputate parts of ourselves. So they're always there, and they're always waiting. But because they were hidden, as a result of our deciding that they were ugly or dangerous or would cost us something we weren't willing to lose, it's hard to recover them, because the recovery, the attempt to recover, also brings back the taboo, the early learning, the discouragement, the pain, if there's pain attached to it, and usually there is. I'm treating a number of people whose the experiences of their first couple of years were so unpleasant that their ability to feel safe is undercover. Their ability to not be vigilant every minute of the day is undercover. So it is the intention of this show, as well as the intention of all the work I do, to make this point, to say, you may be living a cover story, that's what I call it. That's the version of yourself that was acceptable. It's the truth, but it's not the whole truth. It is likely that you have buried some aspect of yourself, and that your life is poorer because of that. It's obvious if you can't feel safe, if you have to be worried, watching, and vigilant every minute of the day, how much richer your life would be if you didn't have to do that. But it's also true that if you were a natural artist, that sitting with a blank sheet of paper and a pencil or a crayon or a pen, the hours melted away and you created something that you could see evolving and that brought you the most delicious joy, and that somehow you lost the permission to do that, you can see how much richer your life would be if you could get that back. So this is the intention of the Lynn Show, to encourage you to ask the question, is there something? And if there is, the chances are you actually even know it. And then to ask the question, am I willing to try to recover it? Because it really does take courage as I said, when you go after the recovery process, you get back whatever it was that stopped you. So it can be difficult. This is, of course, what psychotherapy is all about. This is, well, one of the things that psychotherapy is meant to do, is help us to be all that we are. So you might want to think about that. You might want to read the article that's up on my website called Psychotherapy on the Go, which talks about what it's like to do psychotherapy on the telephone, which is how I do it these days. And at my website, you can also get the podcasts of all the shows, listen to any of the interviews that I've done before, including the one you're going to hear now. You can get a copy of my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. You can ask me a question by clicking on Email Me. Just ask me anything you like. You can get me to come and talk to your group or organization. There are lots of things to do on my... Oh, but of course I have to tell you what it is. It is thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E off of Lynn. And now, as I do every week, I'm going to play an interview. I interview, as I said, people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you hear a person who has done that talking about their connection to their art, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. And Anne's story is interesting because she is someone who knew very young that she wanted to be an actor and was in some powerful ways discouraged so that she wasn't able to give all of what she wanted to give to it. And yet, when you hear her talking about it, you know, you can hear it, what it sounds like to be who you really are. And so here, Anne Gundersheimer, letting you hear who she really is. Okay, so I am here with Anne Gundersheimer. Did I do that right?
You did that right.
Oh my God.
Well said.
Good. And I'm going to explain to Anne that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And I know that you are at least an actor, perhaps many other things, but at least an actor because I've seen you work. So, well, I saw you in Moonflowers.
Moonflowers.
Yeah, you were wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
You were wonderful.
And appreciate that.
Well, you're welcome. And I know that you're going to be in the tribute to 9/11
at
the Players.
Yep.
Right. And the rain has begun.
As usual.
Yes. So I only ask one question, and it is, how did acting happen for you? How did it start? When was the very first moment in your life when you thought performing, getting people's attention, making people laugh, any of it? Do you know what I'm talking about?
I do.
Oh, good.
I do. I actually have a number of answers, of course, because why not make it more complicated than it is? The first time I really discovered acting on the stage.
Mm-mm. And before that.
Ah, before that.
Yes.
Okay.
As a child, did they say, oh, she's so charming, or she makes you laugh?
No, but my father was a beloved professor in Philadelphia who had a lot of charisma. Mm-hmm. And he used to recite Goethe at home. He was German, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And
he would recite it in the German.
He would recite it in the German, and then sometime, I guess maybe in seventh grade, I had to memorize parts of Julius Caesar, Shakespeare. That was just part of the school curriculum. And I worked with my dad.
On it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he loved what I was doing and loved sort of sharing it with me, and it fit right in with his love of poetry. And that, I think, along with the fact that he was a natural performer, he was a teacher, but good teaching takes great performance.
Yes.
I think probably was the way that I discovered the pleasures of, you know, sort of drama and recitation.
So the picture I'm getting is that your father is actually a natural performer.
Mm-hmm.
Not only in school, but at home. He likes the whole thing of expressing mm-hmm. dramatically, right?
Yes, and very expressive.
Right, and when you get an opportunity to do that, then you have a bond. You have something that the two of you do together. And I'm assuming, from the way you're talking about him, that you loved your father.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
However, I don't think he ever dreamt that I would want to do that.
He didn't know what he was doing.
Right. He created a monster,
yes.
And that was not his intention.
His intention.
Because being an actress was not thought of as something that had great merit or legitimacy.
Yeah, well, let's get to that. So here you are in seventh grade, and it begins.
Mm-hmm.
You get support from him that he doesn't know he's giving you,
mm-hmm.
right?
It's just fun.
We're enjoying the pleasure of it. Right. So okay, then you do it in school, I assume.
So then I do it in school. The first thing I did, oh my goodness, I still remember the first lines. It was some sort of a little show or something, of like a variety show. And I had a poem to read, and it started out, it wasn't actually a poem to read, I had to memorize it and act it and deliver it. And it started out, "My name is Sloth, I am a slattern. You must not take me for your pattern. I spend my days in slovenly ease. I wake when I like and I sleep when I please." I still remember that.
It's lovely. How old were you?
12, 13,
amazing.
Something like that.
Amazing.
And then there was another, you know, classmate who played Tidy, I think her name was, or something like that.
Right.
And that was the first time I ever did anything in front of people.
And it's really clear, because you can still do it, how powerful it was for you.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
All right. So then what happens after that?
So after that, I go to summer camp, and it's an all-girls camp, and they're doing a production of Oklahoma. And I get cast as Will Parker.
Right?
Yeah, yeah. And so that was the first really incredibly fun performance, because I got to act, and I got to sing Kansas City, and I got a duet with Ado Annie. Of course, it was, you know, it was children's summer camp production.
Right.
But that really lit the fire. That really lit the fire.
Okay,
That was just...
Yeah, so you know then that this is something really important to you, that you really love doing this.
Yeah.
Right. And you're singing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I sang.
Right.
I sang, and I never... And then I really never was a musical actor. Did a musical review in college, I guess.
Well, wait a second. Follow the so in high school did you?
Yeah, in high school I went on to act. I was in Arsenic and Old Lace, which every high school in the world did in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was in The Matchmaker, from which Hello Dolly comes. Mm-hmm. That was the original. And I won some poetry reading contests, and that's about what I did in high school.
Okay, so. Is your family becoming aware that this is important to you?
Mm-hmm.
And are they saying, okay, fine, but not but something else to fall back on? Or are they saying...
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
I really wanted to go to straight from high school to study theater, and that was not permitted. And in retrospect, I think it was the right decision. I think my parents felt that... that I should get educated.
Mm-hmm.
And really, I think that to be a good, substantial actor, you need to have a really broad and deep education. So I don't regret that.
So where did you go? What did you study?
So I went to Oberlin College in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
And I studied English.
Okay.
and I acted all the time. Mm-hmm. And I actually did a kind of wonderful thing there. An actor that probably no one around really remembers anymore, but a great actor from the group theater named Morris Karnofsky.
I know
who
he was.
Who at the time had sort of put together a really wonderful interpretation of Shylock in The Merchant of Venice and took it around to various colleges. And I was cast as Portia.
Wow.
In our production of The Merchant of Venice with Morris Karnofsky.
Wow.
And that was maybe the first Shakespeare I ever did, and probably the second or third production I did in college at all.
Wow.
So it was pretty exciting and pretty challenging, and I often think now that I had no idea really what I was doing.
Right. How significant it was, really.
It was hugely significant, and I guess I carried it off. The reviews were good, but I know now that if I were to take it on, it would be a much, I've lived a life.
I was just going to say.
And I've studied acting.
Right,
and
right.
So now it would be different.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get out of college.
I get out of college after doing a ton of things in college. I was very lucky in that even though there was no theater department, there was a huge amount of theater going on.
Mm-hmm. Was there a drama club or something?
It was, there were several different. There was a group called the Oberlin Dramatic Association, which did classics and, did Heartbreak House, George Bernard Shaw, and, just a variety of classical things. And then there was the Mummers that did more original things like original reviews and musicals and student originals and things like Six Characters in Search of an Author, Pirandello, which I did. So
So you got a lot of experience,
mm-hmm.
even though you weren't studying.
Right.
So then what?
So then I applied to graduate school in theater. And I ended up...
Because your parents said okay, or because
well,
by that time you got to be able to do what you wanted?
Because they couldn't really stop me.
Yes, right. Right.
They never really said, okay, that's great, do it. I mean, I actually... I'm very aware of how much support young actors get from their families these days.
Not all. But makes a big difference.
Oh, it makes all the difference in the world.
That's
I mean,
right.
I think, I certainly don't blame my parents for it. I mean, I didn't quite have the personal courage to set out without their approval for various reasons. But I do think if I'd had more support, perhaps things might have turned out a little differently.
Yeah. I make this point as often as possible, by the way, primarily when I'm interviewing people who have had a lot of support, because
mm-hmm.
because it does make all the difference.
Oh, it does.
Yeah.
It does. It makes all the difference in the world.
Right.
But I did go to graduate school.
Where'd you go?
I went to Wayne State University in Detroit. I got to be there during the Detroit riots.
Oh, how nice.
Which was an amazing, amazing experience, probably in some ways more significant and remarkable than even graduate school. It was an amazing time in the social fabric of our culture. But I got a master's in theater and I guess in between, also before that I'd done some summer stock. And then I did summer stock while I was there. And then, so I got my master's in theater, which I think was important to my parents because it sort of legitimized, I came from a very academic family, so getting the master's sort of legitimized my
yes.
love of theater. So then...
So then
I returned to Philadelphia, which is where I had come from. And I was very, very lucky in getting a teaching job at Temple University in the theater department. And I took that job really thinking that I would take it for a few years, save some money, and then go to New York.
Right.
I had lived a very, very meager lifestyle in Detroit. really, you know, sort of hand to mouth. And I didn't want that anymore.
Yeah.
That had no romance for me.
Yes, right. Right. Been there, done that.
Yeah, it was not, it was not, oh, the romantic story of a starving actor. It was brutal. So, so I taught, and then, you know, life sort of happened. I met a man that I fell in love with, and I got married, and had some kids, and realized that I probably was not going to be able to follow
that dream,
for a variety of reasons. Didn't, and I liked teaching a lot, but I didn't want to spend my life teaching other people to act.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't. It hurt. It sort of hurt me.
Yes.
So my kitchen at the time was always full of people telling me their problems. And I was, you know, very happy to hand out all sorts of advice without any training whatsoever. And as my life began to shift and change, I thought, A, I probably ought to know what I'm doing. And B, I probably ought to be getting paid for it.
Yeah, right.
So,
and I, C, I seem to have a knack for it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I got very interested in family therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And Philadelphia was a big center for family therapy training.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided to shift gears and study family therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And I applied to the program at Hahnemann Hospital. And I had never taken a psychology course.
Uh-huh.
And that was one of the prerequisites. So I wrote a defense to my application. And I based it on, I talked about how all the greatest drama was based on the chaos or the harmony of the family. And I traced it from Oedipus Rex through Antigone, King Lear and Hamlet and
through
the Restoration comedies and down to, you know, Tennessee Williams and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. And they took me.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And, you know, I talked about, you know, how much theater prepares you to understand sort of nonverbal communication.
And good dramatists are therapists, or, you know, I mean, it's really the truth, you know?
Yeah, it's integrated.
Right. That's exactly right.
Very integrated.
Right.
So they took a chance, and mm-hmm. they took me, and that's what I did for the next 30 years.
Ah, private practice.
I had a first I worked in a community mental health center.
Mm-hmm.
Those existed in those days. Unfortunately, they no longer really do, or in very minimal ways. And then I worked at a state hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked on a med psych unit at a big city hospital in which it was a really interesting unit in which all the patients had both serious medical issues and serious psychiatric issues.
Right, right.
And so I was the family therapist on that unit. And then eventually I opened a private practice. Mm-hmm. And did that.
No theater all this time?
No theater for 30 years, and then in 2000 I started acting again, 13 years ago.
Where were you? Still in?
I was in suburban Philadelphia, in Bucks County.
Right.
And I started to, and I worked, and I auditioned for the play Sylvia.
Ah.
That a local summer community theater was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest, as they say.
Yes.
Then
right.
I've been acting ever since. I mean, you know, I think if you're bitten by the bug,
mm-hmm.
you don't really ever leave it. And
right.
it's wonderful to be able to return to it. It's really significant to be able to return to it and not have to you know, go into the later years of your life feeling like, why didn't I? And I wish I had, and I've waited too long. And
no, I think actually the point you're making is very valid, and that is that, first of all, it's like a bicycle. That's like, you know, the old bicycle thing. You know, you never forget it.
And get right
you get back on it, right. And also, because we have community theater, and in Sarasota we've got so much of it, it's always available.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get back, it's out there.
It is.
Right?
It is.
And you never get too old for it, because there are always roles.
Not always. Well, there are, but there also aren't. I mean, I spent the last, until I moved here a year ago, mm-hmm. I was working in Philadelphia.
Right.
And managed, and Philadelphia is a huge theater town. It's got wonderful theaters, and more than you can count, probably 50 between the sort of professional, semi-professional, community mm-hmm. theaters.
Right, right.
But it's amazing how really few plays there are with women of a certain age. There aren't that many. It's better down here in Sarasota, I think, because the population is an older population, and so I think, you know, there's more of an effort to do plays that have a wider range of characters. I may be wrong, but that's my impression. In Philadelphia, it was hard. It was hard to find roles to audition for, and then, of course, you have to get the role.
Yeah, right. I'm sorry to hear that. I have a brother who's an actor, and and has the same kind of history, mm-hmm. where he never really did pursue it as a career,
mm-hmm.
right? But he tells me that for older men, there are more roles than there were, that there are always roles for older men, and that may be true.
I think that's true.
Right.
I think that's true.
Not for women
necessarily.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I think there's some real significant gender differences in that.
I think that's right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize, but I think that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you get here? Why did you get here?
So I got here just about a year ago, at the end of July of last year.
Mm-hmm.
I had started to come to Sarasota to visit my best friend who had moved here. And the more I visited, the less I wanted to leave.
Mm-hmm.
It felt wonderful to my body and to my soul. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think as I sit here with you and I'm looking out and at the sky, there was something about this environment that was just healing and lovely for me. And I also, frankly, I'd lived, with the exception of college in Ohio and Detroit,
mm-hmm.
I've lived in around Philadelphia all my life, and I was restless. It was enough. It was time to make a change and to make a shift.
Mm-hmm.
So I moved here really knowing only one person, and I still don't know many people, so if people who are listening want to meet me, search me down.
Yes,
search
right.
me out.
Well, and come out and see you.
Absolutely.
At the Players on 9/11.
On 9/11, yep. It's a wonderful piece.
You want to talk about it as much as you can?
Yeah, I mean, it's a piece that was written shortly after the events of 9/11. And I don't actually know, I would love to know, and we'll try to find out a little bit more about the woman who wrote the play. But it's essentially the story of a fire captain who lost 8 men in 9/11 and who has been asked to speak eulogies at their funerals. And he's at a loss. He simply doesn't know how to put together his emotions, his thoughts, much less write them down and be able to communicate everything that's going on for him at that time. And so someone suggests to him that he speak to this woman who is a writer and is a neighbor of this this person who suggests that to him. And he comes to this character, Joan, who's the character I play, and the play, which is a one-act play, is really about what they do together in this afternoon of trying to memorialize these dear people that he lost. And it's a beautiful play, and it's an interesting play. Both the characters, I think, are very compelling. Mm-hmm. And it's also wonderful just to be able to... the character that I'm playing really struggles with feeling entitled to have feelings about it because she didn't lose anybody. Mm-hmm. But also struggles with how to contribute.
Yes. So, so it's dealing with almost everything that anybody might have experienced as a result of this event.
Exactly.
Right? Those who actually lost people, those who didn't leave, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever is possible to feel comes up in this one act. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. So, it's a very interesting play, and it's lovely to do it on 9/11.
Yes. Yes.
So...
Come down and see it. It's at the Players Theater tomorrow. So the sense of camaraderie, the sense of community, the sense of...
Well, for me, it's much more aligned with all the parts of me that have always been, sort of present in my life. When I'm in a show, and it's absolutely inevitable, it happens every time I perform, there's this wonderful creation of family.
Yes.
It really becomes a kind of family. And there's an intimacy to working with people in the theater that's created by a willingness for actors to be terribly, terribly exposed and vulnerable.
Yes.
I mean, to really do your job well as an actor, you can't hide. You have to be willing to hear difficult things about what you're doing and be asked to do difficult things. And that very interaction creates an intimacy and a closeness among a cast and with a director and even with the tech people who support you that's just absolutely wonderful, delicious, nurturing. And when that ends, that's really, it's the ending of that is really interesting because you all promise each other that you will see each other again. And you really mean it, but it tends not to happen.
No,
so you carry that family inside you. It has fed you. It has become part of your life. But it ends in a way that it's bittersweet. It's not like divorce.
Right.
It's not like death.
Right.
It's like a bittersweet.
As you're speaking, I'm thinking that... that we don't have a lot of that in this culture. This isn't a culture that's about that kind of bonding. This is a... And so...
It's a very solo kind of culture.
It is. It's a very solo kind of culture. The whole idea of, pulling yourself up by your bootstraps and...
The individual,
yeah, right. Ayn Rand and all that stuff. So not a lot of people get... that.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get it, it's so seductive, it's so so compelling. Right.
Yeah, it is. It's a beautiful, that's a piece, when I talked a little while ago about acting in the theater feeling like a lover and making me smile. I mean, this is a big piece of that.
Yes.
It's the connectedness, the caring, and for the most part when you're in a play, we look out for each other. We, in a way that very often in life you don't have.
Yes.
We look out for each other, whether it's in the dressing room to make sure that your straps aren't showing and that your makeup's on right and that your eyelash isn't hanging.
Right.
Or whether it's on stage with someone going up on a line and being there to cover and pick it up.
Yes.
It's lovely.
It's lovely, and I think it's true. We live in a competitive society, and in that context, you're a collaboration.
Yes.
Yeah.
So,
have you thought of writing?
I've done of writing. Why do you ask?
Well, it just seems to me that.
I'm just curious.
It seems to me that you're really well educated. Mm-hmm. You know a lot about theater. Mm-hmm. It's just, I don't know, it just seemed that it would be a natural thing for you to do, especially since you could write something for yourself.
Yeah. I have all my life thought about writing.
Mm.
And I actually have written some poetry, but not for a long time, and wrote a short story fairly recently. But I'm daunted by writing. I really am. I think that it's a place that I don't feel myself truly capable, even though all the things that you say are accurate. I'm knowledgeable and I'm educated and all of that. But
what happens?
And I certainly don't think. I think playwriting is probably the most difficult writing form. That's my opinion, because everything has to be pretty much expressed through dialogue. When you can have a stage direction.
Yes.
But there's no place in playwriting where you can really wax poetic and fill in the blanks. It all has to be done with the characters and how they really relate to each other. I think it's incredibly difficult. And
did you try?
No, I've never tried. I've never tried. I feel defeated. I feel defeated by the very concept of it.
It's interesting, given given what you've already done.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't daunt you to teach, and it didn't daunt you to counsel.
Mm-mm. Mm-mm. No, writing does, though.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Writing
well,
does.
I'm sorry.
Who knows what's in the
future?
That's
exactly right. That's exactly
knows,
right.
Because,
because that is one of the ways to get a vehicle for yourself is to write.
Well, I know. And I know that there are some really powerful, I just saw Annie Morrison's show, powerful actors here in Sarasota who have put together one.
What did you see?
She did a cabaret and is doing a cabaret. She did a cabaret in Venice. It's going to be in.
I know. I'm going to see
the Manatee Players, and it's opening on September 2nd in New York City.
Yes, and
very impressive, wonderful.
I ran her interview yesterday.
Oh, okay.
For the show that will be opening in New York, and I'll be there, actually.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. But, yeah.
So, I know, and she's got another thing that she's doing, which has to do with her mother. It's just not something I have ever taken on. And, life is organic. Who knows what will happen in the future?
Thank you very much, Anne.
Mm. Thank you.
So, I hope you heard what I heard, which is that Anne is a person who knew virtually from the beginning that she wanted to be an actor, that she wanted to use her body, her voice, her psyche to embody someone else, to demonstrate, to express a character. And she started doing it in elementary school with her little speech about being a sloth. And she was not lucky enough to have the kind of support which would have allowed her to pursue that single-mindedly, the way she says and she wanted to. She wanted to go immediately to study theater when she went off to college. She wanted to work for a little while, save some money, then go off to New York and pursue theater. She did everything that she could do, given the confines that she found herself confined by. She gave herself every opportunity to pursue this passion, this desire. But she ran into a number of snags in the form of her parents' belief, her husband's belief, perhaps, the conventional wisdom about what a woman is supposed to be, what is a safe place to be, what is a good thing to do. And because she's also so smart and talented and not limited in her passions, that she could really love teaching until she felt that sadness about teaching others to do what she wanted to do. She could really love being a family therapist, and no doubt an extremely good family therapist, doing a lot of good in the world. She could raise her children. She had a lot of other areas to pursue, a lot of other abilities, capacities. She was flexible, she was resourceful, and she was also talented in many, many ways. And still, that thing that she discovered as a child never went away. So, to her amazing credit, she continued to keep that alive so that she can now do what she always wanted to do, be what she really always was, demonstrate what was the closest thing to her heart. And when she talks about the experience of being in the, quote, family of a cast that is putting on a play, of course, I have heard this many, many times. You hear this really from all actors. The very special experience of bonding in a very intimate way with people who begin as strangers and with whom you don't have a lot of history, although, you know, in long-running shows, those people get a lot of history as well. And I have several friends who have been in long-running shows that have become kind of cult favorites, and they do reunions and they do reprises, and they the feelings that they have about one another, the feelings that Anne describes that are the result of working in this intimate, vulnerable way, they stay. And so these people have a special place in the heart of other cast members. And that, as I said, is something you hear from actors all the time. I quite often hear from actors, I didn't know who I was, I didn't know what I wanted to do, and then I got into drama club, and I suddenly felt at home. I suddenly felt that I was with people who understood me, who spoke a language that I speak. This feeling that one is where one belongs, that's what I've been talking about. The idea that one is doing what is right for one to do, what is meant for one to do, what one came into this world feeling drawn to, and then finding others who share that passion, that desire, familiarity. That is the gift of knowing who you really are. That is the gift of recovering what you may have had to hide, deny, place undercover. Luckily for Anne, she never had to place it undercover. This is an interesting dilemma, because if you place it undercover, you don't feel sadness, regret. You may feel out of sync with yourself. You may feel that there are things about you that you don't know, or that, you know, the old saw, you know, if people knew me, they wouldn't like me, that there are things about me that I'm not demonstrating. But the pain, the regret, is diminished by the fact that you've forgotten this thing. Anne didn't have that. She never put it aside. She never buried it undercover. And so while she was able to do all these other wonderful things and live a really useful life, it stayed there, always, always in her awareness. And again, to her amazing credit, she has been able to embrace it, resurrect it, call it back, you know. And so she's having the experience, which I want everyone to have, that of being who you really are, of being all that you really are, not pretending, not denying, not hiding. So that's the plan, the wish, the intention of the Lynn Show. And of course, this interview with Anne demonstrates it in so many ways. It's so perfect. And of course, this is why I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because they are people who know who they are in some profound way. And as I said earlier, it is my hope that when you listen to someone like Anne talk about what it feels like to be on stage, what it feels like to be a member of a cast, what it feels like to be doing what she knows she was meant to do, I hope that this is inspiring to you. And again, if you have any questions for me, you can find me and all there is to know about me at my website, thelinshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. And as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something you knew but had forgotten, something you didn't know, something that intrigued you, interested you, inspired you. Something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get, I may be running out.